We want to begin the Norton Lecture Series this morning. The lecturer for the Norton Lecture Series, fall of 2000 at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, is Dr. Nicholas Volterstorff. Dr. Volterstorff received his BA degree from Calvin College in 1953 and his PhD in philosophy from Harvard University in 1956. After spending a year in Europe on a fellowship from Harvard, the Sheldon Traveling Fellowship, he taught for 2 years in the philosophy department at Yale University. He then returned to his alma mater, Calvin College, where he taught philosophy for 30 years. In 1989, he took up his current position at Yale as the Noah Porter Professor of Philosophical Theology in the Divinity School and adjunct professor in the philosophy department and the religious studies department. He's taught for 1 or 2 semester stints at Haverford College, Notre Dame University, Princeton University, the University of Texas, University of Michigan, Temple University, and for 5 years he was professor half-time at the Free University of Amsterdam. He's been the president of the Central Division of the American Philosophical Association and the Society of Christian Philosophers. After concentrating on metaphysics at the beginning of his career, he spent a good many years working primarily on aesthetics and philosophy of art. In more recent years, he's been concentrating on epistemology, philosophy of religion, political philosophy, while maintaining his interest in aesthetics. In the fall of 1993, he gave the Weil Lectures at Oxford University. In the spring of 95, he gave the Gifford Lectures at St. Andrews University in Scotland. And in the spring of 1998, he gave the Stone Lectures at Princeton Seminary on political philosophy and theology. And we're happy to welcome today Dr. Nicholas Volterstorff to give the Norton Lectures at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he will introduce the title of his talk this morning.
Thank you very much, Dr. Parker, and it's an honor to be here and to give these invited to give these well-known lectures. So I look forward to these 2 days together. I call these three lectures together Believers, Theologians, and Philosophers. And what I want to do in these three talks is discuss three aspects of the interrelationship between, or among, I should say, philosophy on the one hand and faith and theology on the other. In this first lecture, I'll be talking about why faith has no need for grounding provided by philosophy. In the second lecture, which will be later today, I'll be discussing faith's role in philosophy, and in the third one tomorrow, I'm going to talk about philosophy's role in theology. In effect, then, what I'll be doing is talking about that classic topic of faith and reason. And I decided on this occasion, rather than doing something brand new, to work out a sort of synoptic statement of how I've come to see the interrelationships among these three, faith and philosophy and theology. For those of you who have read some things I've written, I hope it won't be totally boring, and I hope it won't be what you yourself could have written on the basis of what you've read of what I've written, but nonetheless, it's going to be an attempt to sort of put things together. Let's begin here. From among certain philosophers in the late 17th and then throughout the 18th century, there emerged an intellectual cultural ideal whose importance for the mind of the modern West seems to me cannot possibly be exaggerated. I think this is one of the most important cultural intellectual ideals that emerged. And the ideal that I've got in mind is this. There emerged there the ideal of a religion which is rationally grounded in human nature. That ideal. The ideal of religion being rationally grounded in human nature. I concede that that ideal, in a way, arose among the classical Greek philosophers. But it seems to me that the idea was something new in the Christian West. It had those Greek anticipations, but was something new in the Christian West. Because look, in the Christian West, there had long, from the time of the High Middle Ages, there had long been the ideal of a scientific theology, or given our connotations to the word science and scientific, that's a little bit misleading. From the time of the High Medievals, there had arisen the ideal of a theology which will meet the demands of what they called scientia. Our word science comes from their word scientia. I know that. Nonetheless, the word has changed its meaning in the interim, and so it's best to just, without being too precious about it, stick with the old Latin word scientia. There emerged the ideal of a theology which would fit the extremely rigoristic demands of a scientia. I'm not going to try to explain this morning too little time what exactly those ideals were. But when I say that in the late 17th century, late 1600s, and on throughout the 1700s, when I say that at that time there emerged a new ideal of a theology which is rationally grounded in human nature, I've got something different in mind from that medieval ideal of a theology which measures up to the demands of scientia. And here are the two crucial differences. For the medievals, it was theology that they had in their mind when they said that we ought to have a scientific theology. For these early moderns, it was religion that they had in mind. And secondly, consequently, for the medievals, it was an ideal for the academic person who was interested in and concerned with constructing a theology. For these early moderns, it was the ideal of everybody. For every human being whatsoever, this ideal of a rationally grounded religion, rationally grounded in human nature, for every human being whatsoever, that was the relevant new ideal. And that's a profoundly different situation. Ideal for everybody as opposed to for academics, an ideal for religion per se, rather than for theology. So a new ideal. The ideal became widespread in the late 17th and on throughout the 18th centuries, and as I say, it seems to me to have haunted our intellectual culture ever since. But I would say, if you asked me, that the two great articulators of the ideal were John Locke at the beginning of the period, in the latter 1600s, and Immanuel Kant at the end of this formative period, at the end of the 1800s. They were the two great formulators. Now, my aim today this morning is to just give you a feel for what this ideal came to, rather than to describe all its variations from one thinker to another. So I think what I'm going to do is mainly describe the ideal as it emerged in the hands of John Locke, and then ever so briefly after I've done that, give some indication of how it differs in the hands of Immanuel Kant, and leave it there. So Locke's version of the ideal. Here's another reason for concentrating on Locke. I think that Locke's version of the ideal became far more formative of American intellectual culture and American theological and religious culture than Kant's ever did. I mean, Kant's had influence, no doubt, but I think Locke was the great formative figure. So let's begin with Locke. I'll explain what the ideal comes to, but first this. Why did this ideal of having religion rationally grounded in human nature emerge in the hands of John Locke, a new cultural intellectual ideal? To understand why it emerged, in my opinion, we've got to recall some of the crisis that faced Western Europe at the end of the 1600s, middle 1600s, the crisis that confronted European culture. Here was the crisis. Many of you will know that medieval intellectual culture was largely text-based. When a course was announced, there was a standard set of texts, and basically the professor commented on these texts and added some additions of his own and so forth. And the medievals, for the most part, were of the conviction that the large body of texts which they inherited from antiquity and from their own predecessors in the Christian tradition, the medievals were persuaded that this enormous body of texts, with the exception of a few blatantly heretical ones, so those could be tossed out, but otherwise, this enormous body of texts constituted for them altogether a body of wisdom, an extraordinarily intricate, finely articulated, superbly developed body of wisdom. You boot a few out, but the rest gives you wisdom. They knew, of course, that there appeared to be contradictions in these texts. They knew, of course, that Tertullian seemed to be saying something quite different from Clement of Alexandria. They knew, of course, that St. Paul was not a carbon copy of Aristotle and so forth. They knew all that. Nonetheless, here was their basic picture. They saw the texts of pagan antiquity as preparatio evangelii, as preparation for the gospel. So the standard picture was that Christianity superseded the great texts of antiquity, but it didn't really, on deep issues, contradict them. That Paul told us more than Plato told us, but for the most part didn't contradict Plato and so forth. So the pagan texts were sort of, when properly read, preparation for the gospel. They were our schoolmasters leading, I'm quoting Clement now, our schoolmasters leading us to Christ just as the prophets did. Okay. And then they saw the whole body of Christian texts as getting at one and another side of this wonderfully complex thing, which is wisdom. So the challenge of the interpreter was to extract this wisdom from these texts by establishing the right hierarchy. So you interpret Virgil in the light of St. Paul and not St. Paul in the light of Virgil, obviously. You make the proper distinctions where it seems that there's a contradiction at hand. You say, but we must distinguish. And then you say, Augustine, who seems to contradict Tertullian, Augustine was really getting at this side of the truth and Tertullian was really getting at that side of the truth. When appropriate, you use allegorical interpretation. So you say that Virgil was speaking allegorically here and allegorically was alluding to some truth of the Christian gospel. You get the point? So the student learns the right strategies of interpretation so as to extract this wisdom from these texts. Nobody supposed that these texts were infallible. People didn't think that wisdom was infallible. And by the time we get to the high medievals, this, as they call it, dialectical study of these texts was seen as inferior to this other thing that they called scientia, which I won't try to explain this morning. Nonetheless, it's wisdom, and the goal is to extract the wisdom. I think that seems to us, if you see what I'm saying, a very alien way of reading texts. I submit that, without knowing most of you, my guess is that absolutely nobody in this room reads the great body of texts bequeathed us in this way, that altogether it provides us with one wonderful body of wisdom. We have come to relish the disagreements. Okay. By Locke's time, late 1600s, so century and a half, century and a quarter after the beginning of the Reformation, by Locke's time, pretty much everybody had come around to the view that you and I have. I suppose that there may still have been some Catholics in Spain and Italy who believed that the pre-Reformation texts were to be read like this, contained a unified body of wisdom. But nobody supposed that when you put the pre-Reformation texts together with the Reformation texts, that this constitutes a unified body of wisdom. Nor did anybody really think that when you put all the Protestant texts together, that that constitutes one harmonious body of wisdom. Everybody was profoundly aware of the fact that we had a battleground of texts now, that it was not just some unified thing that proper theories of strategies of interpretation would extract wisdom from, but that it was a battleground of opinion, not a harmony of wisdom. And as you all know enough of your history, I dare say, as you all know, this breakup of the textual tradition was accompanied by political strife throughout Northwest Europe. I mean, people were killing each other over religious differences. That's the situation. Now, it was in that situation that this new ideal emerged. In effect, Locke is asking himself, when we no longer can believe that we have a unified textual tradition, on the basis of which we can form our opinion on important matters, when it's no longer possible for us to believe that this heritage of texts is one unified body of wisdom, how then do we go about forming our opinions and convictions on important matters of ethics and religion? And how then do we live together in society when we no longer have a unified textual inheritance by reference to which we can form our civic and political opinions? That was the question. And I think to understand how Locke was thinking, we've got to realize that in Locke's thought, latter part of the 1600s, in John Locke's thought, Locke is always operating with a distinction between tradition on the one hand and human nature on the other. Tradition versus human nature. Diverse traditions, no longer a unified tradition, diverse traditions versus shared human nature. However different our traditions are, religious traditions for Locke and ethical traditions, however different our traditions are, we nonetheless remain human beings. We nonetheless retain our nature as human beings. So, here's the vision. And I don't think we can, you know, understand its the power of the ideas that result without seeing why the vision emerged. So here's the vision. When it comes to matters of God, duty, and civic life, let us build on what we share in common as human beings rather than on what divides us as adherents to diverse traditions and religions. That's the way ahead. And I hope that even though I've sketched it out very briefly, you can, as I say, have a sense of the grip of this vision. When we're all on the basis of our traditions arguing with each other, why not live together and form our opinions on the basis of what we share together as human beings, which we all are? And that invites this next question, obviously. And what might it be in human nature that is capable of providing us with the principles for shared convictions about God, duty, and civic life? Nice to say nature instead of unified nature instead of diverse traditions, but what is it in our nature that would provide us with the principles? And Locke's answer is reason. You've really got to hear that with a capital R. Here's what Locke says, I quote him directly. Listen to the voice of reason. And you've got to hear that like this. Not to the voice of your own private tradition. Listen to the voice of reason. For we, as human beings, all have a voice of reason. I think for our purposes, it's important to go beyond the slogan. I mean, the slogan helps, but it's important to go beyond the slogan to understand what that slogan actually came to in Locke's hands. Otherwise, we won't begin to see how influential this vision of religion as needing rational grounding was. What the slogan came to in Locke's hands was a version of what's come to be called classical foundationalism. Once again this morning, I'm not going to try to define that for you, but I think I can give you a picture of how Locke was thinking, and you can sort of see why this picture of a house with foundations is an appropriate picture. What emerged was classical foundationalism. Here's what Locke said. You're considering whether to believe something or not. Basically, it makes no difference what. Some theological issue, some ethical issue, some political issue. Even some scientific issue. you're deciding whether to believe it or not. And you want not to appeal to your own private tradition. You want to appeal to what you share in common with your fellow human beings. How do you proceed? Let me say how Locke thought we should proceed. And my sense is that this is going to seem to you utterly bland. And I think the reason that it will seem to you utterly bland is that it has so shaped our thinking in the modern West that we say, well, tell me something new. I mean, here goes. How should you shape your thinking? Some issue? What do you do? What you do first, says Locke, is collect a satisfactory body of evidence. You need, as it were, an evidence base. So you collect a satisfactory body of evidence. And what would a satisfactory body of evidence be? Well, I'll add one other thing, but here I can say this. A satisfactory body of evidence will be an ample body of evidence. You don't just look at one supporting item, but however many is necessary to make it ample. And secondly, you'll see to it that your evidence isn't skewed. You won't just look for negative evidence, and you won't just look for positive evidence. That would be skewed evidence, but you look for representative evidence, representative and ample. So, body of evidence, an evidential base. What do you do next? That's the first step. I'll say one more thing about the evidence shortly. You've collected the evidence. What do you do next? Says Locke, you calculate the probability of the proposition in question that you're considering. You calculate the probability of the proposition in question on that evidence. Parenthesis. This notion of probability was almost a brand new notion in Locke's day. Once again, it's not really bland now, but it was a brand new note, virtually a brand new notion in Locke's day. You calculate the probability of the proposition in question on the evidence. Seems sensible, right? Given the evidence, how likely is this thing to be true? And thirdly, says Locke, what you do is you, this is a nifty third step, you believe or disbelieve the proposition with a firmness which is proportioned to its probability on the evidence. If it's extremely likely to be true, you believe it with great confidence. If it's extremely unlikely to be true, you disbelieve it with great confidence. If it's somewhat likely to be true, you believe it with some bit of confidence, and you can flesh it out for yourself. So you match your confidence in it to its probability on the evidence. Okay. And now the evidence has to be ample and representative, but what about the individual items of evidence? So I go back to the evidence base. Here's what Locke said. See to it that your items of evidence are certain for you. Not just likely. See to it that the items of evidence are certain for you. And which sorts of things might be certain for us human beings, asks Locke. Well, basically his thought is the things that are smack in front of your mind's eye and that do not go beyond what's present to the mind. So some conceptual truths like 1 + 1 = 2 and either it's cool outside in Louisville today or it's not the case that it's cool outside in Louisville today, some purely conceptual truths like that, and reports of what's going on in your mind, like I'm feeling dizzy or I'm feeling cool or I'm feeling warm or something like that. I mean, the basic thought is, how can you be mistaken about those? When you don't at all go beyond what's smack in front of the mind's eye. Beautiful picture. And Locke's basic thought was this. We human beings cannot do better than that. How could we possibly do better? And start with certitudes. Collect an ample and representative body of those. Calculate the probability of what we're wondering whether to believe or not on this evidential set and believe with the firmness proportion to the probability. How can a human being do better than that? That's the way out of our muck of disagreeing opinions. One more point here. That's when Locke says, listen to the voice of reason, that's really a sloganistic way of referring to this Lockean method of you know what it is now. These three stages, collecting the right kind of evidence, calculating the probability, and proportioning the firmness of your belief to the probability. Three-stage process. One more point. Actually, Locke didn't think that we should always employ this method. He didn't think we could. It takes too much time. You'd be dead if you insisted on doing this for everything. I mean, you just can't. All the beliefs that you've got now about somebody talking to you from up on high and in a largely white building and so forth, you can't calculate the evidence for all these things. So when do we do it? Only for those matters which are, now Locke uses what is for us old English here, but I think it's very nice. Only for those matters which are of maximal concernment. you know, which concern us more than anything else, maximal concernment. And which are the matters of maximal concernment? For human beings in general, Locke thought matters of religion and matters of ethics. Do you see the bite? Every human being, every adult, sane human being, okay, every human being ought to use the Lockean method when it comes to matters of religion and when it comes to matters of ethics. These are universally matters of maximal concernment for human beings. And since religious truths are not just reports of what's going on in your head, beliefs about God, what follows is this. You've got to collect evidence for your beliefs about God. God isn't just an idea in the head, something out there. So you've got to build an evidential set and collect the arguments. That's why it was. Now let me go back. Hence it was that there emerged from Locke this ideal of a religion which is rationally grounded in human nature. Not in tradition, but human nature, and grounded by reasons, by this Lockean method. That's why it emerged. And I submit that from Locke's time onward, this vision, as I put it, has haunted the intellectual culture of the West. Not our aunts and uncles who are grocers and carpenters. I don't suppose that they're haunted by this ideal. But it seems to me that anybody who enters the academy and anybody who enters the colleges and universities of the Western world bumps up against this ideal in one fashion or another. To be, let me put it as simply as I can, to be a responsible believer, says Locke, to be a responsible believer, you've got to collect that sort of evidence for your beliefs. Your religion must be rationally grounded not in your own private tradition, but in human nature. Now, ever so briefly, I mentioned that you also find this ideal in Immanuel Kant, almost exactly a century after Locke. Let me ever so briefly indicate how it differs in Kant from how it emerges in Locke. First is this. It's never been very clear to me exactly how Kant thinks the ideal fits up to the ordinary human being. For Locke, every adult ought to do this, and some of you, if you're just bumping up against this for the first time, are saying, well, how does this weary mill worker in England possibly going to follow this elaborate method when it comes to matters of religion and morality? Locke's answer was, look, everybody's got time on Sundays and holidays. whenever I say that and read it in Locke, I think, well, yes, Locke, but they're exhausted. I mean, they've got time, but they're exhausted. They're going to sleep on Sundays and holidays. Well, anyway, Locke thought that everybody on Sundays and holidays had time to follow this method for religious and morality and consequently ought to do it. It's not so clear to me what Kant thought. Clearly, Kant thought that the ideal was something that philosophers and academics ought to adhere to, but how exactly he thought it measured up to the ordinary person is just not very clear to me. Kant did, in fact, pretty clearly hold the view that Christianity would progress in such a way that eventually everybody would, in all likelihood, hold a religion rationally grounded in human nature. But whether he thought this was an obligation is less clear to me. Secondly, the other big difference in Kant is this. Basically, Locke thought arguments for God's existence would start from the existence of oneself and then the conditions of existence of oneself and so forth. A more or less traditional set of arguments are what Locke gave. Whereas Kant, as many of you will know, thought that the only possible arguments for God's existence and the immortality of the soul would have to start from the human moral life. So not from the facts of existence, but from human morality. But otherwise, there's this same ideal of a religion rationally grounded in human nature. It'd be nice if I had the time to talk about the influence of this ideal. I've alluded to it, but haven't really talked about it. Let me say just to make just a few remarks about that, and then go on to why I think we have to give up the ideal. Let me just observe that the ideal, so far as I can see, in its Lockean form, was embraced by most American evangelical Christianity of the 19th and at least the first half of the 20th century. And it's for that reason that we have coming from the hands of evangelicals in the 19th century and on till the, well, I don't know, the 1960s, whatever. It's for that reason that we have coming from the hands of American evangelicals books of the sort Evidence, More Evidence, Yet More Evidence, Yet More Evidence, and so forth. And books in which there are arguments for God's existence, arguments for the infallibility of Scripture, arguments that for the divinity of Jesus, and so forth. You will all have, if you haven't read such books yourself, you will have all heard about such books. And I think, secondly, that this ideal shaped the American evangelical colleges of the 19th and the 20th century. When you look back at how these colleges were structured in the 19th and on into the 20th century, the structure was pretty much this, and the understanding. In the ordinary disciplines, we would study chemistry and physics and so forth, and ultimately what we'd do is discover design arguments for God's existence and historical arguments for the infallibility of scriptures. And then what was typical in all these colleges was that the president of the college would teach a capstone course to the seniors, in which the president pulled all this together, assembled what you knew about physics and so forth into design arguments for God's existence, and assembled what you knew about history into historical arguments for infallibility, and then pull it all together in a capstone course, rationally grounded religion for the seniors. This can be documented by actually, has been documented by actually looking at the curricula of these colleges. And in Baylor, for example, in the early part of the 20th century, the president was still teaching such a capstone course structured along these evidentialist lines. So it has powerfully shaped American evangelical Christianity. Okay. It's high time that I move on now to the second part of my talk. My title, you remember, was Why Faith Has No Need for Philosophy's Grounding, and what I meant, why faith doesn't have to have this rational grounding in human nature. But all I've done so far is describe the ideal and not why we should reject the ideal. So let's move on to that. Over these centuries, there have been a number of attacks on the ideal. I think you should read Kierkegaard as attacking the ideal in the 19th century. I think we should read Schleiermacher, the great German theologian of the 1820s, 1830s, as attacking the ideal. In general, people who are more or less, thinkers who are more or less closely located in the Romantic tradition, like Schleiermacher and Kierkegaard and so forth, attack the ideal. But it seems to me anyway that they didn't succeed in locating the nub of the issue. Clearly they reject the ideal. You can't read Kierkegaard without seeing that he wants nothing to do with a religion rationally grounded in human nature. But I submit in Kierkegaard it's mainly the alternative is mainly presented with hammering rhetoric rather than giving you a close analysis of what's wrong with the ideal. I think that the movement called Reformed Epistemology, of which I'm a member, has succeeded in locating the Achilles heel in the ideal. And I'm a little bit embarrassed to put it like that, since it sounds too grandiloquent and so forth, but I think that's what happened. So let me briefly say what I think the Reformed epistemologists have contributed to the discussion. Now, one way of putting what the Reformed epistemologists have argued is this. Religion, religious conviction, religious belief, does not have to be rationally grounded to be rational. I say one way of putting what we Reformed epistemologists have argued is religious belief does not have to be rationally grounded to be rational. That's a nifty way of putting the point, and it's not really an inaccurate way of putting the point, but I do think it's a sort of misleading way of putting the point. So let me move on beyond the nifty to the more accurate now. And here's the more accurate way of putting the point. You know, beliefs, convictions, have a whole variety of different merits and correspondingly defects. One merit in beliefs is that they're true. I mean, it's a good thing about a belief that it's true, right? And a corresponding defect in beliefs is that they're false. One merit in beliefs is, I suppose, that they make you feel good. A demerit is that they make you feel depressed. And beliefs do that. You come to believe, on good evidence or poor evidence, that you flunked the exam. My guess is that that'll make most of you feel bad. You come to believe, on good evidence or bad evidence, that you got an A in the exam, and my guess is that most of you will feel good as a consequence of that. And that's a good feature of beliefs, that they make us feel good or make us feel bad. It's got nothing to do with truth or falsehood. You may, in fact, have passed smackingly, but for some reason or other, you got the wrong information when you heard that you got an F, and conversely, you may have flunked it when somehow or other you came to believe that you got an A for it. So it's got nothing to do with truth or falsehood. Another good thing in beliefs is, that they're reliably formed by some sort of reliable process you came to this belief. Another good thing about beliefs is that they are what I call entitled, that they're something that you're entitled to believe, that it's okay for you to believe. Some things you shouldn't believe that you do believe. We say, you shouldn't have believed his side of the story without also listening to her side of it, right? And we teachers are constantly using shoulds to our students. You should have known that. You shouldn't have thought that. You should have looked up. You shouldn't have asked your roommate, but you should have looked it up in the textbook and things like that. So beliefs have this obligatory and permissible quality to them as well. Entitled. Okay. Now, the conclusion I want to draw from that is this. Beliefs have a whole variety of distinct merits and demerits. Not just one. It's been a feature of epistemology in the 20th century to talk as if there's just one merit, and then it's been asked, what is rationality or what is justification? But, as I've been saying, I think we ought to recognize that there's a whole diversity, and that's becoming increasingly recognized in the guild. So here's what the Reformed epistemologists have really argued. Religious beliefs, beliefs about God, can have the merit of being a case of knowledge, one merit, or of being an example of entitled belief, another merit. Religious beliefs can have the merit of being knowledge or entitled without being rationally grounded. That's the better way of putting it than the nifty way I began with. They can be rational without being rationally grounded. The more precise way is, that's nifty, but the more precise way is the less nifty way. They can be entitled, or cases of knowledge, without being rationally grounded. Let me put that a little differently. You can be entitled in your religious beliefs. Your religious beliefs can even amount to knowledge without their being held on the basis of arguments. Without there being held on the basis of evidence. That's the idea. Now, on this occasion, I can't possibly give you the full argumentation, but I think I can give you the basic idea. I mean, so here's the question. How can it be that contrary to this ideal, I can be entitled to beliefs about God without holding those beliefs on the basis of argumentation? Why is it that all those books about evidence are off target in a way? Why can it be that my convictions about God might even amount to knowledge? Let me try to give you the basic idea. When you think about it, we all believe lots of things without believing them on the basis of arguments. I find for my students that this takes them aback when I first point this out. But of course it's true. I believe that I'm awake now. But I don't believe that on the basis of some argumentation that I've gone through. In fact, I wouldn't know what the argumentation would be. If I'd try to do it, it would prove circular, I suspect. You believe, I think most of you believe that you're awake. I mean, it'll look over you and it looks to me as if most of you are awake, and if you are, you probably believe that you are. You don't believe that on the basis of some sort of argument. You believe you're feeling warm or cool or just right now. You don't have some sort of argument for that. If I asked you for an argument, you'd be perplexed, I suspect. In any case, you didn't believe it on the basis of an argument. So, start there. We do, and I think you can see that we have to believe lots of things not on the basis of argumentation. I say have to. Well, you've got to get some beliefs in your head in order to have premises for arguments, right? I mean, an argument takes premises. Well, those premises might also have been the conclusions of arguments, and those might have been the conclusions of arguments, but somewhere you got to get something in your head as premises which you didn't draw from other premises. So it looks as if it's got to be like that. Okay? And the second step is this. And surely lots of such, what philosophers call immediately formed beliefs, are responsibly held beliefs. You're entitled to it. Though I don't believe it on the basis of an argument that I'm awake now, it's surely okay for me to believe that. All of you who believe that you're awake now, who didn't go through an argumentation process, and none of you did, I'm sure, surely it's okay for you to believe that you're awake. Or you believe that you're sitting on a bench. You didn't go through some argumentation for that. You just sat down and just believed I'm sitting down on a bench. And it's okay for you to believe that. In fact, it amounts to knowledge. So here's the initial point. There are lots of things we do believe, not on the basis of any argumentation at all, let alone argumentation from just human nature, on the basis of no argumentation whatsoever, that possess the relevant merits. We're entitled to them. They even constitute knowledge. Okay? And now you can see where it's going. So here's the next question. And why cannot the same be true for at least some religious beliefs? Why cannot the same be true for at least some religious beliefs? Why do they all have to be held on the basis of argumentation? Why do they all have to be rationally grounded in the deliverances of human nature? And I don't mean the religious beliefs of little kids or of people off somewhere, but I mean you and me, people who've studied and are academics and so forth. And I think, don't have the time to go into the argumentation, I think the answer to that question that I just posed, why can't some religious beliefs also be ones that it's okay for us to hold without holding them on the basis of arguments? I think the answer to that why can't is they can. Now that's generated a lot of controversy, but I think the situation still is, it is the case that some religious beliefs it's perfectly okay to hold without holding on the basis of argumentation. It's okay to hold them on the basis of experience. People experience the world as the gift of God. People experience God as speaking to them, and so forth. People experience the heavens as manifesting, bespeaking the glory of God. Usually when they have that experience, it's not an argument that they've got, but an experience that, I don't know, overwhelms them. Now, I see no reason to think, and it seems to me the state of the debate is such that there's no reason to suppose that all of such beliefs are immediate beliefs about God are non-entitled. In other words, what you got to do is point out some relevant difference between such beliefs and our ordinary perceptual beliefs and beliefs about being awake and so forth, and I think nobody has succeeded in doing that. So let me pull things together. I've got to conclude. Here's what I've suggested. Out of the intellectual and political crisis of the 17th century, there emerged a new, for the West, for the Christian West, and powerful ideal. I've called it the ideal of religion being rationally grounded in human nature, in the deliverances of human nature. In Locke's hands, this took the form of arguing that philosophy provides to faith an indispensable assistance, because it's the philosopher who constructs these arguments, of course. That was Locke's idea. What the philosopher does is it provides faith with the arguments which are necessary for faith to be responsible. That was the vision. Instead of trying to meet the demand, which is what both the evangelical and the liberal West has done, to accept the vision and try to meet its demands, providing the arguments, I think we ought to reject the vision. Let's be careful. Let me close with this. This doesn't mean that philosophy has no services to offer faith. If I believed that, I would not be a philosopher. And in fact, I'll be talking in my third lecture about the services that philosophy can offer faith. Secondly, it doesn't even mean that, in my view, it's bad for philosophers to try to offer such evidence and so forth, for what it's worth, if it's possible. Here's the point. It's not true that faith, to be responsible, has to have rational grounding constructed by philosophers in the deliverances of our mere human nature. Faith may arise, instead of being from arguments from the universalities of human nature, may arise from the particularities of religious experience, and that's okay. In the next lecture, this has been a negative lecture. In the other two, I'll talk more positively. Thanks.